Well, Anicca is doing its thing. And this retreat is coming to its end. So, first thing, when you go back out to the unreal world, you will probably find it weird. This is because it's weird. Right? You've been in a place of sanity for the last 2 weeks, and it's going to seem strange out there. Sometimes when people leave a retreat, particularly a concentration retreat, the readjustment to the unreal world is a bit stressful. If you've ever had a problem leaving a retreat before, I suggest you start backing off on concentration. After this talk, you know, do insight practice all day tomorrow and on Thursday morning. If you never had a problem leaving a retreat, feel pretty confident you can readjust to the insanity out there. Adjust to insanity. Then, okay, keep doing the concentration bit. If you're somewhere in between, then at some point start backing off. The schedule tomorrow will be the same, except that what happens at 10:30 will be a number of announcements. There'll be announcements about, you know, cleaning your room, doing your final chores, that sort of stuff. There'll be the Dana talk. I think there's, it'll probably be 15, 20 minutes. And then the Dana talk, so half hour or more of that sort of stuff. And then there'll be an extended question and answer period. This is not optional. Everybody needs to come at 10:30 for the announcements and instructions and everything, and stay for the whole of the Q&A period, except for the two people who have to go wash dishes. Okay? I got to start bringing you guys back. All right? And so there'll be a bit more talking than usual tomorrow. The afternoon will be the same. Evening will be the same. There'll be a Dhamma talk, etc. And then Thursday morning, there'll be the sitting before breakfast. We'll break silence at breakfast. And then after breakfast, after you've finished your final chore, you're free to go. Any questions about any of this?
Has anything horrible happened while we've been here?
Just the same old horrible stuff that was happening when you came in. It's just continued, all of it. There's a volcano in Iceland that's threatening to erupt. It may or may not spew ash into the air and close down air traffic all over Europe. It looks better than it did a few days ago. It's no longer under the glacier. But, of course, no one has any idea what it's going to do. So that's not a horrible thing that's happened. Mostly it's just the same old horrible stuff that was going on before. Just continue. Anything else? Okay.
Any great stuff happened?
Any great stuff happened? They don't do a 6 o'clock super report. I can't remember anything really great happening. It's just stuff as usual.
So we don't talk until breakfast on Wednesday?
Breakfast on Thursday. So not tomorrow, the next day. Okay, so tonight what I want to do is answer Catherine's question. What is this perception that's not ordinary, not abnormal, not ceased, and not false? What kind of perception or consciousness was the Buddha speaking of when he said that brought an end to rupa? So
you're going to remind us which sutta it's in.
Oh, that was from Sutta Nipata 4.11. Okay, the Quarrels and Disputes Sutta. The original Sutta on Dependent Origination. Okay. So, what we want to do tonight is take a look at some suttas that describe Nibbana. I guess if tonight's talk has a title, it would be a Sutta Description of Nibbana. I'd much prefer to do a personal description of Nibbana, but you're going to have to work with this. Thus have I heard. At one time, the Blessed One was staying near Savatthi in Jeta's Grove at Anadipindika's Park. On that occasion, the Blessed One was instructing, rousing, inspiring, and gladdening the bhikkhus with a Dhamma talk connected with Nibbana. And those bhikkhus, being receptive and attentive and concentrating the whole mind, were intent on listening to the Dhamma. And then, on realizing its significance, the Lord uttered on that occasion this inspired utterance. There is bhikkhus, that base where there is no earth, no water, no fire, no air. No base consisting of the infinity of space, no base consisting of the infinity of consciousness, no base consisting of nothingness, no base consisting of neither perception nor non-perception. Neither this world nor another world nor both, neither sun nor moon. Here, bhikkhus, I say there is no coming, no going, no staying, no decreasing, no uprising. Not fixed, not movable, it has no support. Just this is the end of dukkha. This is Udana 8.1. The Udana is another collection of suttas that's found in the Kutika Nikaya, the fifth collection. This particular collection has 80 suttas. And so this is from Book 8, and it's the first sutta. So the Buddha is giving a Dharma talk on Nibbana, and he says there is this space where there are none of the four elements, none of the immaterial states, neither this world nor another world nor both, neither sun nor moon. Here I say there is no coming, no going, no staying, no decreasing, no uprising. Not fixed, not movable, it has no support. Just this is the end of dukkha. This is a very non-dual teaching. The Buddha is saying that there's no opposites, there's no conceiving of the elements, the immaterial states, no sun, no moon, this world, another world. No coming, no going, no staying, no decreasing, no increasing, not fixed, not movable. So Nibbana is a state beyond duality, is what is being said here. If we take a look at Udana 8.2. Now the Udana means inspired utterance. So each of these 80 suttas in the Udana has a prose part, and then on realizing the significance of that, the Buddha utters a divine utterance, the Udana, which is the verses. Sometimes the prose part and the verses really go together well, and sometimes you're left scratching your head going, what? Most scholars feel that the verses in general are older than the prose in general, although there are probably suttas particularly where they go together, where the prose and the verses were composed at the same time. So 8.2 has another prose part, which is identical to the previous one. The Buddha is giving a Dhamma talk at Jeta's Grove, Anadipindika's Park, on Nibbana. And then he utters, "The uninclined is hard to see. The truth is not easy to see. Craving is penetrated by one who knows. For one who sees, there is nothing." Perhaps for one who sees, there's no thing. All right, so this is difficult to see. Thanissaro Bhikkhu translated it a little differently. It's hard to see the unaffected, for the truth isn't easily seen. Craving is pierced in one who knows, for one who sees, there is nothing. So one who sees, who penetrates craving, and hence penetrates dukkha, sees not in terms of things, sees beyond things, sees beyond dualities in particular. Another sutta, Udana 8.3, identical prose section. And then on realizing the significance, the Blessed One on that occasion exclaimed, "There is, monks, an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unfabricated. If there were not that unborn, unmade, unbecome, unfabricated, there would not be the case that freedom from the born, become, made, fabricated could be discerned. But precisely because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, fabricated, freedom from the born, become, made, fabricated is undiscerned." So this is probably the most famous description of Nibbana found in all the suttas. This was Thanissaro Bhikkhu's translation. John D. Ireland says, "There is a not born, not brought to being, not made, not conditioned." Sometimes we find it, there is an unborn, unbrought to being, unmade, unconditioned. When it says an unborn, unmade, unbecome, unconditioned, there's 8 words there, right? Only 5 of them are wrong. Okay, Pali doesn't have articles. There's no a, an, or the. So it's not that there is an unborn or the unborn. It's not what the Buddha is saying. These are past participles. So there is unborn, unmade, unbecome, unfabricated, to use Tom Jeff's translation, or unconditioned, to use the usual translation. But a past participle in Pali serves much the same purpose as a gerund in English. Gerunds are the ing words. So we could translate there is not giving birth, not making, not becoming, not fabricating. Not conditioning? That doesn't make much sense. It turns out that translating asankhata as unconditioned is just incredibly wrong. It just has no basis in what was being talked about. And then when you hear the unconditioned, you've thrown in a the, which doesn't exist in Pali, and then translated this very important word incorrectly. It's not fabricating or not concocting. And who is the fabricator? Who is the concoctor? Right? Me. Right? I'm the one who's fabricating this as a table. I'm the one who's fabricating as a telephone booth for leprechauns. I'm the one who's fabricating it as firewood. Okay? So, what the Buddha is saying here is there is a way to look at the world without giving birth to things, without making things, without things becoming, and without fabricating them. This is how you escape from rupa. You look at the world and you recognize the holistic input, but you don't bother to chop it up into bits and pieces. Now, people who have a serious immortality project want to make it the unconditioned, because then Nibbana becomes an ontologically existent place or thing. And then they can have union with it, right? And when they die, they go into Nibbana. And then Nibbana becomes, well, just like the Christian heaven. But as I said last night, you better hope it doesn't have ontological existence, because since it's unchanging, it's not going to let you in. It's a realization. It's a realization of the world as it is without fabricating it into bits and pieces. When you can take in the world, not chopping it up into bits and pieces, then there's no rupa there. There's no things. There's no materiality. There's just the sensory input. We actually had this during the Anicca talk. At the end of Majjhima Nikaya number 121, the lesser discourse on emptiness, the Buddha says that one goes beyond the village, beyond the forest, beyond the notion of earth, beyond the immaterial jhanas, and one rests in emptiness. All that there is just the happening of the senses. What's present is present, the happening of the senses, and what's not present, the village, the forest, earth, water, etc., is not present. This is giving us a hint of what the Buddha's pointing at when he talks about Nibbana. It's not a place, it's not a thing, it's a realization. And it's a realization of experience the world as sensory input. They're just colored shapes. They're just sounds. And it's sort of before you start chopping it up into bits and pieces and identifying it as tree and bird and so forth. Okay.
This last one, was that 8.3?
Yeah. So that was suttas Udana 8.1, 8.2, and 8.3. So, we have another sutta from the Udana that's more famous, perhaps. This is Udana 1.10, the Bahiya Sutta. Thus have I heard. Once the Blessed One was staying near Savatthi in Cheta's Grove on Anantapindika's Park. And at that time, Bahiya of the bark cloth was living by the seashore at Supaparaka. He was respected, revered, honored, venerated, and given homage, and was one who obtained the requisites of robes, alms food, lodging, and medicine. So Bahiya of the bark cloth is a holy man, and he's living at Supaparaka by the seashore. I think the scholars identify Supaparaka as the area over by what is now Mumbai, Bombay. While he was in seclusion, this reflection arose in the mind of Bahiya of the bark cloth. Am I one of those in the world who are arahants or who has entered the path to arahantship? So he wants to know, have I achieved the goal of the spiritual path, or at least am I on the right path that will lead to arahantship? Then a deva, who was a former blood relation of Bahiya of the bark cloth, understood that reflection in his mind. Being compassionate and wishing to benefit him, he approached Bahiya and said, "You, Bahiya, are neither an arahant nor have you entered on the path to arahantship. You do not follow a practice whereby you could become an arahant or enter the path to arahantship." Then deva, in this world, including its devas, who are the arahants and who have entered on the path to arahantship? There is Bahiya in a far country, a town called Savatthi. There the Blessed One now lives, who is the arahant, the fully enlightened one. That Lord Bahiya is indeed an arahant, and he teaches Dhamma for the realization of arahantship. Then Bahiya of the bark cloth, profoundly stirred by the words of that deva, then and there departed from Supaparaka, stopping for only one night at each place along the way. He went to Savatthi, where the Blessed One was staying in Jetis Grove, Anuttapindika's park. Now, this sentence sometimes gets mistranslated in that he went from Supaparaka to Savatthi in one night. All right, but no, what it means is he departed and he stopped for the night and slept and got up the next day and kept going. He didn't spend two nights in the same place. He was determined to get there. So look out for this mistranslation that shows up fairly frequently. So he arrives at Jetis Grove, Anuttapindika's park. At that time, a number of bhikkhus were walking up and down in the open air, doing walking meditation, obviously. Then Bahia of the bark cloth approached those bhikkhus and said, "Where, reverend sirs, is the Blessed One now living, the Arahant, the fully enlightened one? We wish to see the Lord who is the Arahant, the fully enlightened one." "The Blessed One, Bahia, has gone for alms food among the houses." Then Bahia hurriedly left Jetis Grove. Entering Savatthi, he saw the Blessed One walking for alms food in Savatthi. Pleasing, lovely to see, with calm senses and tranquil mind, attained to perfect poise and calm, controlled, a perfected one, watchful with restrained senses. On seeing the Blessed One, he approached, fell down with his head at the Blessed One's feet, and said, "Teach me Dhamma, O Blessed One, teach me Dhamma, so that it will be for my good and happiness for a long time." Upon being spoken to thus, the Blessed One said to Bahia of the bark cloth, "It is an unsuitable time, Bahia, for we have entered among the houses for alms food." Now, at that time, if you were a mendicant, someone who got your food by begging, and you were a teacher, it was not appropriate to approach that teacher and ask for teachings. Because if the teacher stopped to give you teachings, by the time he finished, there wasn't going to be any alms food. The tradition was that those who were preparing the alms food would prepare the food for the family and some extra to give to the Buddha and his disciples and members of other spiritual traditions who were also beggars. And this would happen probably about mid-morning. And so you didn't go up to a teacher who was on alms round and beg for teachings. But Bahia just did. A second time Bahia said to the Lord, "It is difficult to know for certain, reverend sir, how long the Lord will live or how long I will live. Teach me Dhamma, O Blessed One, teach me Dhamma, so that it will be for my good and happiness for a long time." A second time, the Blessed One said to Bahia, "It is an unsuitable time, Bahia. We have entered among the houses for alms food." A third time, Bahia said to the Blessed One, "It is difficult to know for certain, reverend sir, how long the Blessed One will live or how long I will live. Teach me Dhamma, O Blessed One, teach me Dhamma, so that it will be for my good and happiness for a long time." Sometimes if you ask a Buddha politely, three times, he might grant your request. Herein, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In seeing, there will be merely what is seen. In hearing, there will be merely what is heard. In sensing, there will be merely what is sensed. In cognizing, merely what is cognized. In this way, you should train yourself, Bahia. For when Bahia, in seeing, there is just seeing. In hearing, there is just hearing. In sensing, there is just sensing. In cognizing, there is just cognizing. Then, Bahia, you will not be with that. When, Bahia, you are not with that, then, Bahia, you will not be in that. When, Bahia, you are not in that, then, Bahia, you will neither be here nor beyond nor in between the two. Just this is the end of dukkha. Now through this brief Dhamma teaching of the Blessed One, the mind of Bahia of the bark cloth was immediately freed from the asavas without grasping. So the Buddha gives a very short discourse, and Bahia wakes up. Okay, so how did the Buddha know to give this guy this particular teaching that was going to be so very effective? Well, Don Johnson, who's sitting right back there, pointed out to me that in the Upanishads, there's a teaching that goes something like this. In the seen, there is your Atman, the unseen seer. In hearing, there's the unheard hearer. In sensing, the unsensed senser. In cognizing, the uncognized cognizer. This is yourself. This is your soul. This is your Atman. This particular teaching comes from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, one of the earliest of the Upanishads. And that Upanishad makes a big deal about trees. So the Buddha's walking along on alms round, and this guy dressed as a tree, wearing bark cloth clothing, right, rushes up to him and throws himself at his feet and wants some teaching. And so the Buddha knows this guy's practice, knows he's a serious practitioner of what's in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad because he's dressed appropriately like this. Now, the commentaries say that he was dressed that way because he was a shipwrecked sailor. Remember, he was living at Supaparaka by the seashore. And the commentaries say he was a sailor who was shipwrecked and washed ashore naked. In order to cover himself, he covered himself with bark cloth. People thought he was a holy man, gave him food, he decided it was a good gig. The commentaries had no clue, which is often the case. They knew nothing about the Upanishads. The commentaries were written in Sri Lanka, like 800 years after the Buddha's death. They had no clue what was going on. But the Buddha did. This guy at his feet is a serious practitioner of the Upanishads. And so the Buddha says, no, man, in seeing there's no Atman, there's just seeing. In hearing, just hearing. In sensing, there's just sensing. In cognizing, there's just cognizing. When you can do this, Bahia, there's no you in that. There's no you in this. There's no you in between. Just this is the end of dukkha. Through this brief Dhamma teaching of the Blessed One, the mind of Bahia of the bark cloth was immediately freed from the asavas without grasping. He became totally awakened. Then the Blessed One, having instructed Bahia with this brief instruction, went away. Not long after the Blessed One's departure, a cow with young calf attacked Bahia of the bark cloth and killed him. This seems to be a rather common hazard at that time. It's sort of like, I guess, drunk drivers today. Somebody went to the weekly sitting group, and on the way home, they were T-boned by a drunk driver and killed. Only they didn't have drunk drivers back then. They had cow with calf. The cows are just wandering around, you know, no fences or anything like that. And you see this calf over here next to that cow, and there's a cow over here, and you know not to walk between the cow and the calf, and you walk between the calf and this other cow, who turns out to be the mother, and she attacks you and kills you. It happened actually quite a lot. Not only did it happen to Bahia right after he became awakened, there's a story of the king of Taxila, which is where a famous university at the time of the Buddha was located, hearing of Buddhism, resigning his kingship, and traveling to find the Buddha in order to become a monk. He actually encounters the Buddha and hears a discourse from the Buddha and becomes a non-returner, third stage of awakening. But Before he could actually receive the full ordination, he was attacked by a cow with calf and killed. This is the story of Supabuddha the leper. Supabuddha saw this gathering of people and he thought it might be a distribution of free food. So he went along to see could he get some free food. But no, it was the Buddha giving a Dharma talk. So he sat down in the back and listened, and he reached the first stage of awakening, stream entry. But he too was soon after killed by a cow with calf. There's a story of one of the generals of King Pasenadi, who also was killed by a cow with calf. It seems to be a hazard from that time. Now the commentaries tell us, bless their little hearts, it was the same cow. They ignore the fact that these took place far apart and tell us that these four guys, in a previous incarnation, had hired a prostitute, and after having their pleasure with her, instead of paying her, they killed her. And now she's come back as a cow, and she kills them. The commentaries are full of, well, malarkey. Right? So, anyhow, it was a hazard that happened, and it happened to poor Bahia. He got killed by a cow with calf. When the Blessed One, having walked for alms food in Savatthi, was returning from the alms round with a number of bhikkhus, on departing from the town, he saw that Bahia of the bark cloth had died. Seeing this, he said to the bhikkhus, "Bhikkhus, take Bahia's body, put it on a litter, carry it away and burn it, and make a stupa for it. Your companion in the holy life has died." "Very well, Reverend Sir," those bhikkhus replied to the Blessed One. Then taking Bahia's body, they put it on a litter, carried it away and burned it, and made a stupa for it. Then when they were done, they went to the Blessed One, prostrated themselves, sat to one side. Sitting there, the bhikkhus reported what they'd done, and then said, "What is his destiny? What is his future birth?" "Bhikkhus, Bahia of the bark cloth was a wise man. He practiced according to the Dhamma and did not trouble me by disputing about Dhamma. Bhikkhus, Bahia of the bark cloth has attained final Nibbana." Then on realizing its significance, the Lord uttered on that occasion this inspired utterance. "Where neither water nor yet earth nor fire nor air gain a foothold, there gleam no stars, no sun sheds light, there shines no moon, yet there no darkness reigns. When a sage has come to know this for himself through his own wisdom, then he's freed from form and formless, freed from pleasure, freed from pain." This inspired utterance was spoken by the Lord. Thus I have heard. Okay, so the Buddha says to Bahia of the bark cloth, "In seeing, let there just be seeing. In hearing, just hearing. In sensing, just sensing. In cognizing, just cognizing. Don't go dividing the world up into bits and pieces. Just be present with the happening of the moment in your senses. Just rest in that. When you can rest in that, there's no you in that. There's no you in this. And there's no you in between. Just this is the end of dukkha." Because Bahia had been practicing resting in his senses, he knew how to do that, except he'd been looking for his Atman, his self. And the Buddha says, "No, just rest there." That was enough for him to wake up. What you see when you rest there is neither water nor earth nor fire nor air gain a foothold. There gleam no stars, no sun sheds light, there shines no moon, no darkness reigns. There's no materiality, there's no light, and there's no darkness. We're beyond dualities. When a sage, a Brahmin, has come to know this for himself through his own wisdom, then he's freed from form and formless, freed from pleasure, freed from pain. So again, a teaching on non-duality. Usually non-duality is spoken of as non-dual without object and subject. But there's also non-duality without object and not object, or object and other objects. When you see a tree, you divide it out of the forest, right? So you've made an object of the tree, and you've made a not object of the forest, and you've made a subject of yourself. And the Buddha's saying, no, just see what's seen and leave it right at that. So what the Buddha's pointing to when he says consciousness or perception that is not ordinary, not abnormal, not ceased, and not false, is just resting in the senses and doing nothing else, like making an Atman that's seeing objects. Don't do the subject-object duality. Don't even do the object-not-object duality. We have another sutta about this. This comes from the Digha Nikaya, the Long Discourses, and this is Digha Nikaya number 11, the Kevata Discourse. Kevata was a layman who lived in the city of Nalanda. Nalanda was just north of Rajagaha, which was the capital of the kingdom of Magadha. You might have heard of Nalanda because eventually, many decades, centuries later, there was a university there. It was quite famous and lasted until the Mughal invasion and Buddhism was wiped out in India. So, thus have I heard. Once the Buddha was staying near Nalanda with a large company of bhikkhus. And at that time, Kevata approached the Blessed One, saluted him, and sat down at one side, and said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, you should send some bhikkhus into Nalanda to perform miracles. This will impress the townsfolks, and they will be sure to give you lots of food, lodging, robes, and medicine if you're ill. And the Buddha says, this is not how we teach Dhamma. Kevata, there are only three miracles. The first miracle is the miracle of the supernormal powers. Being one, becoming many, becoming one, appearing and disappearing, walking on water, diving into the earth, passing through walls and ramparts unimpeded, flying through the air like a bird, stroking the sun and moon, wielding mastery over the body as far as the Brahma world. But everybody knows that if you have a Gandharan charm, you can do all these things. So if I send monks into town and they walk in water and fly through the air, people will just think, oh, they've got a Gandharan charm, and nobody will be impressed. The second miracle is the miracle of telepathy, knowing the minds of others. But everybody knows that if you have a Matika charm, then you can know the minds of others quite easily. So if I send bhikkhus into town and they engage in mind reading, everybody will go, oh, they've just got a Matika charm, and nobody will be impressed. No, Kevata, there is only one miracle that really counts. This is the miracle of instruction. And what is the miracle of instruction? A Tathagata arises in this world. A fully awakened Buddha who teaches the Dhamma, which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. A householder or a householder's child or some other person hears the Dhamma, gains faith, and goes forth into the homeless life. Having gone forth, they practice the precepts, guard the senses, mindful of their activities, content with little, abandon the hindrances, practice the four jhanas, gain insight into the nature of reality, overcome the asavas, and become fully awakened. So Kevata gets taught the gradual training, just like King Ajatasattu got taught the gradual training. After this teaching on the gradual training concludes with someone becoming fully awakened, the sutta takes a rather abrupt shift. I'm guessing it's two suttas stuck together. As I mentioned, this happens fairly frequently in the long discourses and the middle-length discourses. So I'm guessing there was another sutta to Kevata. And the new sutta starts out, Kevata. Once there was a monk who attained to such a degree of concentration that he was able to go up to the lowest of the heavenly realms. He went there because he wanted to know where do the four elements cease without remainder. And so he went up to the devas of this lowest of the heavenly realms, and he said, excuse me, good sirs, can you please tell me where earth, water, fire, and air cease without remainder? And those devas said, we don't know. You should ask the guys in the heaven above us. They might know. So then that monk entered into a deeper state of concentration and went to the heaven above that and went up to those devas and said, excuse me, sirs, can you tell me where the four elements cease without remainder? And those devas said, we don't know. Ask the guys upstairs. And so that monk entered into a deeper level of concentration. You get the picture, right? Mm-hmm. Up he went through the heavens, everywhere asking, and everywhere being told, we don't know, ask the guys above. Up, up, up he went, until he reached the heaven of the retinue of Brahma. And he went up to those devas, and he said to the retinue of Brahma, excuse me, good sirs, can you tell me where the four elements cease without remainder? And they said to him, we don't know, but you should ask Brahma. Brahma knows everything. Well, where can I find this Brahma? Oh, we don't know that. But how can I ask him? Well, if you'll be patient, he might just show up. Well, how will I know when he arrives? Oh, you'll know. There'll be a bright light and lots of smoke and the sweet, sweet smell of incense. So that monk went over into a corner and sat down and started meditating. It wasn't too long before there was a bright light and lots of smoke and the sweet, sweet smell of incense. And Brahma arrived and bellowed in a loud voice, I am Brahma, creator of the universe, Lord of all. I am great Brahma. I know everything. I see everything. And so that monk went up to him and said, excuse me, sir. Can you tell me where the four elements cease without remainder? And that Brahma said to him, I am Brahma, great Brahma, creator of the universe, Lord of all. I know everything, I see everything. And that monk said to him, you already said that. I didn't ask you who you were. I asked you, where did the four elements cease without remainder? I am Brahma, great Brahma, creator of the universe, Lord of all. I know everything. I see everything. Look, guy, you already said that. Come on, answer my question. Where do the four elements cease without remainder? At that point, the great Brahma put his arm around the shoulder of the monk and led him aside. And after they had stepped aside, he said, look, these guys think I know everything. I don't know where the four elements cease without remainder. But by the looks of you, you're a Buddhist monk. Go ask the Buddha. He'll know it. He's a really smart guy. So, as quickly as a strong man could extend his arm or draw it back, that monk disappeared from the realm of Brahma and arrived back on earth. And he went to the Blessed One, saluted, sat down at one side, and said to him, Venerable Sir, where do the four elements cease without remainder? And the Buddha says, you've been as far as the Brahma realm looking for the answer to this question, and not finding it, now you come back to me. But you should not ask your question in this way, where do the four elements cease without remainder? Instead, this is how the question should be put. Where do earth, water, fire, and air no footing find? Where are long and short, small and great, fair and foul, where our name and form wholly destroyed. Or better yet, where do name and form come totally to an end? And the answer is, where consciousness is signless, limitless, and all illuminating. That's where earth, water, fire, and air no footing find. That's where both long and short, small and great, fair and foul, that's where name and form all come to an end. With the cessation of consciousness, this all comes to an end. Thus the Lord spoke, and the household of Kevata delighted and rejoiced in his words. Okay, so what does this mean? The Buddha won't answer the question, where do the four elements cease without remainder? But he will answer, where do they no footing find? Remember in the Udana after the Bahia prose, it says, again, there is this place where earth, water, fire, and air no footing find. And then goes on about light and dark, pleasure and pain. Here it's where consciousness is signless, limitless, and all illuminating. That's where the four elements no footing find. They're long and short, small and great, fair and foul, their name and form all come to an end. So consciousness that is signless, limitless, and all illuminating. We generally become conscious of something by dividing it from the rest of the universe. We see a tree and we divide it from the forest. You see the bell and you divide it from, well, the colored shapes that are up here in your visual field. And you make a thing out of it. The signs by which we identify things are to be ignored. You're to have consciousness that is signless, limitless. There's no boundary. If it had a boundary, it wouldn't be signless. There would be a boundary. And all illuminating. When you can actually look at the world like that, nothing is hidden from view. There is just the visual field. There are just the sounds, just the smells, tastes, textures, and just the activity of the mind. That's where earth, water, fire, and air no footing find. That's where long and short, small and great, fair and foul, that's where nama, rupa, materiality, mentality, name and form all come to an end. With the cessation of consciousness, this is all destroyed. That's how the last line is translated here. Which, what? Huh? Didn't make any sense. It was like, what? You got to go unconscious? It didn't make any sense until I was in a course with John Peacock, and he mentioned that the literal translation of vijnana is divided knowing. You become conscious of something by dividing it from the whatever is not that. You divide the tree from the forest. You divide the bell from all the other objects here. Okay? And all this is destroyed. Destroyed is one meaning of the Pali word, which I've forgotten what it means, what the Pali is. But better yet is comes to an end. With the cessation of divided knowing, all this comes to an end. So what the Buddha is saying, well, it's basically what he told Bahia. In seeing, let there just be seeing. In hearing, just hearing. In sensing, just sensing. In cognizing, just cognizing. When you can do that, you're not conceiving of solids, liquids, gases, and energy. You're not thinking of long and short, high and low, fair and foul, light and dark, mentality or materiality. With the cessation of divided knowing, you have arrived at consciousness that is signless, limitless, and all illuminating. This is Nibbana. This is experiencing the world in such a way that craving and clinging are not possible, because there's nothing to crave and nothing to cling to. Having begun beyond craving and clinging, just this is the end of dukkha. Any questions?
So, as far as I know, seeing is organizing the sensory inputs.
Right.
So, what is seeing and just seeing then? Because you need to see colors and shapes.
You still see colors and shapes. Or actually, it turns out all you see are contrasting colors. Okay? And that you still see. You just don't go getting lost in what it is you're seeing in terms of objects. You don't do the perception, the sanya bit, of dividing it up into things. Right? It doesn't make it easy to cross the street. But it does, when you can see that, give you basically the experience of the empty nature of the universe. There's just the sensory input there. That's all there is.
But that's something that's very easy to do. You just look at the same thing without moving your eyes and keep them open, and it will naturally get to that state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nibbana's not far away. It's right here, right now. But you need to do it in such a way so that you realize that that's all that's going on. That when you drop out of that, you don't have to go grasping and clinging at the objects that do reappear when you do the perception bit. And unless you get it so deeply that you no longer are doing the craving and clinging, it doesn't work.
Someone who has that ability or that who sees that can also walk around and talk to people and they could come and live in the real world.
Yeah. How does the Buddha cross the road?
Yeah. Why does the Buddha cross the road? To get to the other side. I think an enlightened being automatically can drop into that seeing is just seeing state when appropriate, and seeing the fingers versus the peanut butter and jelly sandwich when appropriate. That's my best guess. That full awakening means that you take the right perspective automatically. You don't have to think, oh, I need to step back and just be resting in the seeing. That when there arises a desirable object, there's this automatic stepping back and seeing it without the craving and clinging. But when it's necessary to cross the road, then there's the seeing, there's a bus coming, and you don't step in front of it. This is my best guess. As I said, I'd really like to give you this talk from personal experience, but this is the best that I can do.
I don't really know enough about the Christian mystics, but it sounds similar and kind of an almost psychotic or just out out of the ordinary perception.
If there is indeed the truth with capital T's, there is only one of those, and there are probably multiple ways to get to the top of the mountain. So Ayakema actually studied the Christian mystics, and she said some of them were jhana practitioners. And the ones who really got it, like Meister Eckhart, got the same thing the Buddha got. Yeah.
Julian of Norwich.
Julian of Norwich, yes. Quite possibly.
It makes me think of those, sometimes they're called four-dimensional pictures.
Yeah, it's just a bunch of dots till you get your gaze right.
It pops out at you.
Yeah.
Magic eye.
Is that kind of in reverse, I guess?
Yeah, we've got it here. We need to pop it out back into the dots. But there are no dots. There's just, yeah, just the happening of the senses. Yeah.
Or maybe it's just a different paradigm that you see the world. You don't actually see a big blur of colors.
No, I think it looks exactly like this. You just don't go getting lost into the craving and clinging.
I mean, yeah, exactly. It's not that you go and when you need to cross the street, you go like, change it.
Well, I think there probably has to be a shift of perspective. So from the absolute perspective, there's just what's being seen. And then when you go to cross the street, there's the recognition of what's being seen, and you don't need to step in front of it. Yeah. This is my best guess. The Buddha says in Digha Nikaya number 9, the Potapata Sutta, that a Tathagata can use the words I, me, and mine and not be fooled by them. So it's the ability to step back and see this view of the world so that there's no craving and clinging, not being fooled by this has arisen and it's going to give me lasting satisfaction. Right?
Shinzen Young called that kind of seeing an undifferentiated field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, undifferentiated field would be a very good word, a phrase to use for it. Yeah. As I said, you know, this is what I found in studying the suttas. It's not an ontologically existent thing. It's a realization. And I really, really, really wish I could tell you that, it's from my experience. So if you don't trust my interpretation, I would strongly suggest that you go and get fully awakened and then see for yourself, and then you can come tell me. Okay?
Kind of like, you know, the pilots, they have the heads-up display, the visor that comes down.
Mm-hmm.
Like an onboard perpetual filter that sees everything or hears everything, and it filters out any kind of craving or attachment, or just knowing or something.
Yeah, you get a heads-up display that displays the impermanent nature of everything you're looking at.
Right.
Yeah. You look at a very attractive person and you immediately see their very bad family history and the fact that they're a psychotic. Or whatever. You see the cake and you immediately see all of the calories and the extra roll down here. Yeah. Right.
Have you gone through Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Pasano's book,
The Island? Yeah, brilliant book. I've actually read it twice. Yeah. It's The Island by Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Pasano. You can download it from the Abhayagiri website. You can get a copy of it, I think, if you write to them. Send them some money for postage. Send them some money as a donation. But a very, very good book. And one of the things that put me on to this view was from that. The first time I ever heard the Kevata Sutta told, I had read it but I didn't get it, was Ajahn Amaro telling it on one of his retreats and doing a much better job. He's a great storyteller. He had the names of all the heavens and everything. Yeah.
They say that they wrote it because they felt that people didn't realize that stream entry was really possible, and they wanted to really point people to to how to do that.
Yeah.
Besides trying to sort of pull together all these sutra references, but it really had this purpose of trying to really inspire people.
Yeah, and it's a brilliant book. It really is an excellent one. Definitely recommend it. And it contains one of my most favorite quotes from America's greatest yogi, Yogi Berra. If you don't know where you're going, you're liable to wind up someplace else. And so that's why it's important to get some idea of what the Buddha is talking about with Nibbana. Because if you don't know where you're going, you're liable to wind up someplace else.
So this is related also to the notion of still point in Zen Buddhism.
The notion of still point in Zen Buddhism. I don't know enough about the still point in Zen Buddhism to say for sure, but quite possibly. Ayakema uses the phrase still point in saying that when you're really concentrated, if you're really in touch with the fact that you're willing to give up everything for the truth, you should let your mind go and see if it will go to the still point. So she may have taken that phrase from Zen. Because if you do let your mind go and it does go to the still point, that's the experience without an experiencer, the experience of Nibbana that would constitute stream entry.
Is the still point the state of mind with the right term? That's the one I use. Is equanimity what's associated with this way of seeing?
Yes, if you're seeing in this way, you would be very equanimous. Because there's no thing to get upset about.
And no rapture.
And no rapture. But there is, it seems to be, a blissful state.
Okay.
Because you stop covering up the naturally occurring bliss that's there.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be an equanimous, blissful state. So I have heard. I think so. I think it's probably more sukha-like than piti-like. But, you know, I don't know for sure. I would highly recommend going and finding out for yourself. Yeah.
So, is there a place for metta at all?
Certainly, metta practice takes you in that direction. Because metta practice is taking you out of your self-concerns. You're wishing the best for someone, not because of what they do for you or what they might do for you, but just because they're someone. So it's beginning to break down that solid self. Will metta take you all the way? We were discussing this at 11 o'clock or 11:30. Certainly, metta practice done well enough so that you're always operating from love and compassion would mean that you would not have any greed or hatred. And that's what's required to uproot those two for the third stage of awakening. I think there still has to be some insight into not-self to break through the conceiving of a self. But it certainly would be helpful along the way.
Nibbana moment.
Mm-hmm.
So what is he describing when he's referring to that?
Yeah, there's a book called Nibbana for Everyone. You might be able to find a PDF of that on the website. And he's saying that, if I remember correctly, and you should look it up rather than quote me, that when you have a moment of seeing the world clearly without craving and clinging, you're having a moment of Nibbana. So, an experience without craving and clinging. He's calling it a moment of Nibbana.
He says that we have these mm-hmm. regularly every day.
We need to recognize.
If we didn't, we'd all fall apart.
Yeah. So we're having these and we need to recognize them. They're taking us in the direction we want to go. It's an interesting thesis. It's certainly worth practicing. Yeah, everything I find by Ajahn Buddhadasa is brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I did actually get a chance to meet him, and yeah, it was like way cool. If you can get beyond chopping the world up in bits and pieces so you can grab hold of it, yeah, you're practicing being enlightened. Yeah, that's good. Okay. Oh, yes.
How would you put this together with that the Buddha at some point said, I think he was asked,
I don't remember a sutta where he says metta is all. Yeah, he says noble friends and noble conversations are all, but I don't think he said metta was all. Noble friends and noble conversations are all you need to realize this, because hopefully some of your noble friends are totally awakened and they can tell you what you need to do. I think that's what he's saying. Because, you know, Ananda had a very noble friend, the Buddha. So it's all the practice that you need. It's the whole of the spiritual life. In other words, this is going to provide you the support, all of the support that you need. But you're still, I think, going to have to do some practice. Okay, we'll take a short break and then I'll do metta.